You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA. You know ID in the D in the town all day. ID in the D in the SEA.
Hello and welcome to episode 14 of the Fabulous Peltoncast. I'm your co-host Kevin Pelton.
And I'm Tristan Caracino. And you recently spent all of last week in Portland.
In cold, sometimes snowy Portland, Oregon. Yeah, that's where we recorded the emergency Chris Peterson podcast last Friday via Skype while I was down there. And got the chance to take in three Blazers games in four nights. They won the first two, big win over Oklahoma City, then a blowout of the Utah Jazz, before finally seeing their winning streak snapped by the Dallas Mavericks, Monte Ellis nipping them at the buzzer.
Succumbing to the Dallas Mavericks.
Really just kind of a victory for, low percentage shooting with Monte Ellis. No, I kid because I'm actually writing about Monte Ellis today, but that's not what we're going to talk about.
What was the tenor like? Let's talk about the Blazers for 1 second. What was the tenor like of those games? Is the mindset in Portland such that the fans in Portland think that this is a team that has the potential to win the championship?
You know, I think they're still more cautious than that for the most part. It's funny, I actually have, I would say, as many Blazers fans, like, you know, still a little bit reluctant to go all in talking to me on Twitter and in chats is, why are you underrating this team so much, is usually the case. And they're still not quite selling out games. There are a surprising number
they're
of empty seats.
Selling
at the
out
Oklahoma
games.
City. Yeah, there's a surprising number of empty seats at the Oklahoma City game. Dallas was almost sold out.
Was there a Sonics contingent at the Oklahoma City game?
I think I saw, like...
Has that kind of died?
I think I saw, like, one woman wearing a 90s Sonics sweatshirt. That was pretty awesome. But there was actually, I saw, like, a Sonics jersey, I think, on Friday night. So there may have been as much on Friday night as Wednesday night.
What?
It has died down, yeah.
Well, that's really interesting. But the most important thing, so we didn't have any tailgating last week, and won't have any tailgating in this coming week, but in Portland, you stopped by the Rogue Brewery.
Yes, made my first visit there on my first extended trip down to Portland and picked up three beers for us to try out over the next few weeks.
Let's save what those other beers are.
Okay.
Let's just talk about this one. And it's the weirdest beer that I've ever had in my entire life. And that's the Rogue Beard Beer.
Yeah, it appealed to me because of my interest in beards.
Uh-huh.
And past having a beard. And you're currently, as we speak, having
a
beard.
I do have a beard.
And so apparently it's made from yeast from their brewmaster's beard.
Now, I don't know what that means, and I'm scared of it.
I don't know either. It sounds disgusting, but apparently
it's
okay.
Is my beard going to start growing yeast?
Maybe your beard is already growing yeast.
It said that brewmaster John Meyer has had his beard since 1983, and I have not had this beard since 1983.
No, that's not.
So maybe if I have it for 20 years, then I'll start... 30 years, sorry. Math. I'll start growing yeast in my beard. What do you think of it? This is an official Fabulous Peltoncast taste test.
It's not my favorite type of beer.
Yeah. It tastes like yeast.
Yeah.
It's a really yeasty beer.
It really is, which is not my favorite. But it's good for what it is.
You can't taste the beard in it.
No.
You can only taste... Well, I guess you can if it's really yeasty and it's made from... How much yeast is coming out of his beard?
There's so many unanswered questions.
This is a massive amount of beer that they're brewing with his beard yeast.
Probably, yeah. I mean, there's plenty of bottles of this there.
Oh, my God.
But, I mean, it may be like you culture a small amount of it. I don't know. I also don't know anything about the beer brewing process. I'm woefully underinformed on that.
I mean, me too. I don't know anything about it. Just throw some things together.
This has
Just
been...
throw in some beard yeast. But I don't know this is the best beer that I've ever had. I also don't think you're limiting us on this podcast to only having one of the 22-ounce bottles of this Rogue beer taste tested. And I'm 90% done with this already.
Maybe you could pace yourself. I don't know. I feel like for the benefit of the listening audience at home that...
When I get the chance to drink some beard beer, I go all in.
And this way we stretch it out over several weeks, the taste
test.
It's
true, yeah. This has been really good so far. A more beer conversation. I'm going to give this a pass. Pass fail. I don't know. I meant pass as in I would not drink it again.
Yeah, I don't think I would specifically go out of my way to drink it again. It was just something that, you know, you want to try one time to say you've had it.
So
just like we were looking earlier at some of the Voodoo Donut beer that they have, and we had the bacon maple one time, and that was sufficient. I got to say I had bacon maple.
I think
beer.
I might be angry at you, though. You had the opportunity of purchasing Rogue Voodoo Donut Pretzel Raspberry and Chocolate Ale or Portland State IPA, and you went with the Beard Beer. That's what we're drinking right now.
You know, the beauty of it is there will be more trips to Rogue in the future.
It's
we're not
true.
Done taste
it's
testing.
True. So I'm excited about trying the Voodoo Donut Pretzel Raspberry and Chocolate Ale. I'm really excited about that one.
If I hadn't already picked up three other beers by that point, and that was the limit of what I could carry physically, I probably would have gotten that.
Okay, so I've got another bone to pick with you.
More bones to pick.
I'm admitting one of the other beers that you have. The drama's going to be gone. You also got a Pumpkin Patch Ale. And it was December when you were down there, right?
Yeah.
You don't get a Pumpkin Patch Ale in December. This is in October. This is in November.
First off, I will get whatever beers I want.
Oh!
If you wish to get non-pumpkin beers, that's your right.
I do wish.
Maybe I'll drink it alone.
Beers. It's like Christmas, right? So when Christmas is over, you don't want to think about Christmas anymore.
But there's still pumpkin spice lattes and things of that nature.
I don't drink them. I drink eggnog lattes.
Fair argument.
Yeah, it's a really good argument. I drink gingerbread, peppermint, and eggnog. I'm making an advertisement for Starbucks right now.
You really are.
I'm not talking about at Starbucks. I had an eggnog latte earlier today at Cafe Zingara on Lower Queen Anne, and it was delicious.
Did you, look down on people while you were drinking this?
Look down on people?
Was that just in your head?
No, I didn't look down on people. It was really good. It's not that fancy. It's a working-class coffee shop. It's just not a Starbucks. Anyway, we've really got off track here. But we're having some beer, and it's okay. I don't know if somebody was in the listening public, if I would recommend them purchase this.
If you want to try something new, then by all means.
If you've ever wanted to drink somebody's beard.
Yep.
We'll see when I shave this beard off. Brew anything from it. But let's talk about new Husky head coach Chris Peterson. So we talked about this last week on a shortened podcast immediately after the hire. Now he's been announced as head coach, had the initial press conference. Any new thoughts? I think that I have some, but I'm curious what you think also.
I thought in his press conference he struck all the right notes. He was, you know, very complimentary, obviously, of his time at Boise State. Did nothing to step on that or disrespect it whatsoever, but also showed his excitement about the fact that this was the job he finally took after all these jobs that he's been offered in all these years. And, you know, he showed excitement about it. I think he described a philosophy I like and did a good job with the Seattle media, which was one of the concerns about him coming here.
How great is Chris Peterson? Right? Chris Peterson is the perfect human being aside from Pete Carroll and Russell Wilson.
So number three. A solid number three.
He was the most similar. He wasn't probably as snarky as Pete Carroll is. Pete Carroll is a little bit more joking with the media. And Chris Peterson, I mean, this was his first press conference, so he probably wasn't there yet.
Well, he's going to be the straight man to Pete Carroll's wisecracking.
I was so impressed with Chris Peterson, with everything that he said. And I think it's been really cool also over the last week or so to learn more about Chris Peterson, to hear about his family, which is nothing that I ever heard about before, to hear about his success academically with students, which is not something that I care about, but I know that there are people who do care about that.
Me being one of them.
You care about this?
Yeah.
Why?
Because that's the whole mission of the university, not to win football games. That's not why we chartered the university.
Yeah, but we're talking within the parameters. This might be a much larger conversation than this. We're talking about within the parameters of the football team at the University of Washington, they should be paying players, which you agree with, correct?
Yeah.
Should they pay all students?
No.
So then why should the standards be the same for people who are there to play football as they are for students who are there solely to get an education?
Well, I don't think you should be there to play football first.
Basically, the football program functions completely outside of the education of the university. It's just a thing
I think that's a problem.
Why is that a problem?
Because it's supposed to enhance. The idea is that athletics enhance the educational process. That's the reason they exist.
I don't know. It's grown into such a big commodity that whole concept is completely lost from it.
I mean, so you don't want players to do
no,
well?
No, that would be great. And that's what I was saying. That's why it's a good thing. It's just not something that I care about, right? Well, we could have the least successful academic team, and if they won a national championship, nobody would be concerned with this, right?
No, it wouldn't be not, like, but I think that's one of the many problems with college sports.
I mean, I suppose I agree. The bonuses for Chris Peterson and his contract are much higher for winning a national championship than they are for having a high APR or whatever. Right?
They indeed are.
But I was really impressed with Chris Peterson. I think he said all the right things, and I think that I am so sold on Chris Peterson in every way. Everything about him. He's somebody who thinks of UW in the same way that UW fans think of UW.
That's, which is good. Yeah, and I don't think Sark thought of UW necessarily quite that highly, I mean.
Oh, absolutely not. I mean, for Chris Peterson, he was thinking of UW, from all accounts, as the only school that he wanted to go to in the entire country, basically.
It was interesting that he did apparently talk with USC, and the report today, I think it was from the Idaho Statesman, described it as mutual that they decided that it wasn't a good fit.
Mutual?
Yeah.
The Idaho Statesman? He probably actually talked to some person who had nothing to do with the university.
You think he got prank called?
He got prank called.
I mean, that guy is in jail now, so...
He wasn't in jail last week.
It's true.
But my hopes for Chris Peterson are very high, and they're even higher after the press conference. I thought it was really interesting when he talked about... So I was listening to it on KJR, and then he did a quick interview with Hugh Millwin and Softy after... And he was talking about how he came up against a lot of Pac-12 schools in recruiting and found that he was losing a lot of these battles because Boise State just doesn't have the resources, you know? And I think that it's really cool that he recognized that, and that he recognizes all the resources that he has now, and that he's going to be bringing in a lot of these players.
Yeah, I think that's the aspect where we talk about, can he recruit the 4- and 5-star guys? It's not that he wasn't recruiting any of these guys. It's just that when he was in those battles, usually they were opting to go somewhere else. So now you've got the opportunity to come to them with a much more attractive, all-around proposition to play in the Pac-12, to play at a rebuilt Husky Stadium in front of 70,000 fans, and in Seattle as opposed to Boise. So all of that, I think... gives him a much better chance in those battles.
Absolutely. And the other thing that he said about recruiting, which I also thought was interesting, was that the question was, does your list change now that you've come to UW? And Chris Peterson said, my list is always the same. We know who the good players are. It's just that we have a conversation with them early on and find out that they're not in love with us, being Boise State at the time, and they move down from there. So Chris Peterson, working there, is used to working harder at recruiting than probably any other school, harder than somebody like Coach Sark would have ever had to, because he's having to start at the top, right? And work his way all the way down through a lot of 2-star recruits, too.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's different. You know, probably the battles don't get quite as intense as maybe they do at this level, and I think that'll be the difference, but... to me, the most interesting thing he said during the press conference was when I think it may have been Softy again, but asked about quarterbacks and how important it was to have a mobile quarterback.
Yeah.
And he talked about how the top two things he looks for are decision-making and accuracy.
Yeah.
And so that mobility is kind of a bonus on that, which I think matches up with what I think are the most important attributes for a quarterback.
Absolutely. I think that Sark would agree on that also, though. Jake Locker, who you kind of inherited, was not the most accurate quarterback, but Keith Price is an extremely accurate quarterback, and it seems like Silent Miles is in that same vein.
Yeah, you know, I think that's the hope. That's what we saw from him in that Oregon State game, and, you know, with a week of practice as the starter, he was extremely effective, his decisions were good. The one thing I wonder about is, you know, and we'll see how much he retains of the spread off and offense, you know, which he said there'll probably be some elements of.
Yeah.
And then the up-tempo is, I feel like the style that UW moved towards last year, it kind of minimizes the decision-making part to an extent because it's a lot of reads and it's very quick. It's not going through a progression of and looking downfield in the same way.
Well, I would assume that the offense is going to change in a way from what the Huskies were doing this last year, obviously. But I thought it was really interesting when he was talking about Kellen Moore, and he was saying... Kellen Moore never ran for more than 3 yards in his entire time here, but he was an awfully good quarterback. I mean, he was a hell of a lot better quarterback than Jake Locker was, right?
Well, that's the thing. It's like, you know, Jake Locker, he, on paper, had every tool to be a college quarterback, except accuracy.
And I wonder if Jake Locker probably wasn't running... The system didn't even necessarily... It existed, but it didn't exist as full-blown as it does now. But if Jake Locker could have run kind of a true spread back in his years, he might have been much more successful.
I think so, because, again, the question with him was often, A, making an accurate throw into tight spaces, which you're not asked to do as much, and then B, going through that progression of reads.
But I wish that they would have asked him. So Coach Sark is kind of thought of as a quarterback coach, right? He is a quarterback. Chris Peterson was also a quarterback and said that to him, the offense starts with the quarterback and goes from there. He basically, in that press conference, from the very beginning said that quarterback is the most important thing that he cares about. And I was wishing that somebody would have asked, what do you think of the current quarterbacks on the team? I would have liked to have gotten his thoughts on Siler Miles and maybe Keith Price also.
I mean, I feel like it'd be hard for him to answer that because
he's just meeting them.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Price obviously knows pretty well because you scouted against him and seen him start in that Boise State game, but probably Siler Miles they didn't get as good a feel for. And that's really the more important question at this point. I mean, his answer about Keith Price is interesting to the extent that it reveals those same preferences. Mm-hmm. I got to think, knowing Keith Price's historic accuracy, that he would be a Chris Peterson type of quarterback.
But yeah.
Doesn't really tell us much.
Well, I think it'll be important for him going forward to... I think it'll be important for him to name a quarterback right away. Siler Miles is clearly the guy in our minds, right?
Yeah, based on what he did as a starter this year.
And he was great, and I think he's kind of a natural successor to Keith Price, and he'll fit really well in a Boise State-type offense. But I think it'll be really important for him to name Siler Miles the starter before spring practice and to say, this is my guy. And I think it'll be good for the rest of the team, it'll be really good for Siler, and it'll be good for the program going forward to know who Chris Peterson is going to be working with long term.
I agree with all of that, and I don't expect it, because I think his position is going to be, I haven't seen you guys, I need to evaluate you, we're opening up everything.
I wonder if that's the right way to come in. That's the way that Pete Carroll came into the Seahawks, but you can transform an NFL team much quicker than you can transform a college team.
Well, I think the other aspect of it is, you know, Siler Miles is, what, 20? Mm-hmm. And, you know, he's not, it's not the same as, like, Matt Hasselbeck going through competition. That's not going to, like, get his confidence down in 2011 or whatever Pete Carroll's first year with 2010. So that's where...
The competition with Clipboard Jesus.
I mean, it would get my confidence down.
It would mine too.
But Matt Hasselbeck's a pretty confident guy. I think he knew he could still play quarterback. So the difference is... And you want to have your entire team feel confident in the guy. But I think you can potentially do that by naming a starter, you know, at the end of spring practice. I don't think it necessarily has to be before spring ball.
That's interesting. I think I disagree with you there. Well, we'll see how this goes. And I'm really excited for Chris Peterson's first – well, the recruiting period and then his first signing day. I think it's going to be awesome.
See, I'm going to keep my expectations low because the last time we've had these kind of transitions – now, obviously, the last few times it's been coming off of down seasons.
Coming off an 0-12 season.
Yeah. And also the Rick Neuheisel was the other one people point to, his 1999 class. Now, that wasn't as down a season, but obviously it was a case where you were making a coaching change because you were unhappy with the direction of the program, as opposed to something like this where there's so much excitement about what's going on. But it's a tough thing to do, to try to re-recruit in this last, you know, 2 months here before signing day.
But it'll say a lot about what Chris Peterson is going to do, and that's why I'm excited about it. You know, it doesn't have to be the perfect class, but if it's not the perfect class, we can say that he'll have a better class next year, and if it is, we'll say that he's the best coach in the world. We're in a Chris Peterson win-win situation.
Well, besides recruiting, the other thing we're going to be watching over the next couple of weeks is how he fills out his coaching staff. And, you know, I don't know if we know any more than we did last Friday.
He answered that question really well also when he said, you know, we'll see in about a week. It wasn't open-ended. I don't want to talk about that right now. It was, we're still figuring these things out. We'll see in about a week. I thought that was a really good answer.
Yeah, I thought when he managed to give non-answers, I forget what the question was he really gave a complete non-answer to.
We're in love with Chris Peterson right now.
Practice being open was the one that he gave a complete non-answer to. Even when he did it, he managed
to... I hate that question, though. I hate when media asks questions that are only really particularly interesting to media. It's so
self-serving. I think there are enough diehard Husky fans that want every drip of information that's relevant to them, too. So I disagree with that, but, you know... he's been here, you know, 72 hours. Probably whether practice is going to be open is not the first thing he was worried about, but he treated it, like, respectfully and still said nothing.
Yeah.
Which I think is the ideal way to do it.
What a coach. Chris Peterson says nothing and we love him.
The great thing is that you would be exactly this excited about Doug Nussmeier in a different scenario.
I don't know if I agree with that. Do you think that that's the case? I was thinking through this while listening to the press conference, and I don't think that my excitement about Doug Nussmeier would be the same.
Mine would not be, but it's easy to say after
it would be
the fact.
Muted. And really, when you look at it now, the kind of conversation, especially nationally, is that USC hired somebody who is an unproven, mediocre coach, right? And the Huskies hired a winner. They hired somebody who's basically never lost in his entire life. He had one losing season in his entire career, right?
Yeah.
And so it's a big question mark at USC, and it's a big win for UW.
Yeah.
We came out of this much better than we could have possibly imagined probably 2 weeks ago.
I think so, as soon as the Sark news broke, yeah.
And we'll preview the bowl game, which we haven't even mentioned.
Yeah, we're playing in a bowl game. Yay!
For what it's worth, I don't know if playing in a bowl game means much of anything, but we are playing in one.
It's better than not playing in a bowl
game. It's true. It's true. I mean, that's the way I feel about Wazoo. I'm like, pat on the back for Wazoo for playing in a bowl game. For us, I'm like, oh, well, we're playing in a bowl game.
Yeah.
But we'll preview that as we get closer. I'm actually excited about it. I think that the timing of that bowl game works out really well. Around Christmas. I think it'll be fun to have Christmas and then have a day off and then be able to get together and watch a bowl game.
It'll be a good time.
So the amount of weight that I'm putting on it and stock that I'm putting on it, it'll also, I think that I will pay more attention, and I think a lot of people will, just Chris Peterson on the sideline. Everything else is going to be a lot more interesting than the bowl game itself. Tui will be more interesting. Chris Peterson will be more interesting. Will Sark be there is more interesting. A lot of those things will be more interesting than the game itself.
And now I think I'll be really watching the young guys who are a part of the future. You know, the backup halfbacks to the extent they get in there. You know, guys like Demarius Stringfellow. And, you know, everything that they contribute is a positive for 2014.
Yeah, there's a lot there. I am so excited about Husky football.
I could not imagine this a couple weeks ago.
It's really weird, right?
Yeah.
I was feeling really down. We had a game that we didn't even talk about it on the podcast because we were not interested in the game. We forgot to talk about a Husky football game.
Wait, we forgot to recap the Colorado game, was it?
Maybe recap or preview a game. It was just like it didn't even happen. And now, I don't know if I can say what I was about to say. I was going to say that I'm more interested in Husky football than I am the Seahawks.
That's madness.
It's not true. It's just this one moment where there's this big spotlight shining down on Husky football, and it feels like everything is headed in the right direction. Speaking of heading in the right direction, it's tough Seahawks loss this last weekend.
That was your segue. Interesting.
They're still heading in the right direction, is what I'm saying.
I would agree with that. And I think my big takeaway from the two-point loss to the 49ers is nothing changed in my opinion of the Seahawks at all.
I agree, and I think nothing changed in the national opinion of the Seahawks. I think really nothing changed at all. You know, the Seahawks lost a close game to the 49ers that either team could have won. It would have been nice to have won it. Even listening to the Pete Carroll show, did you listen to that this week?
I did.
Listening to the Pete Carroll show, he didn't seem upset about the loss, and I've heard him be upset about losses before.
I liked his answer that, you know, there would have been three meaningless games at the end of the season. He was excited about that challenge.
Yeah, I was excited about that. I thought that was really funny.
But, you know, not going to have to do that. Yeah, which would have been a little bit weird. So now it's actually a pretty important game on Sunday because you probably don't want to be in a position where you have to win both of the last two games of the season.
That's true. Let's come back to that in a second and recap the 49ers game. So a couple things. I have to say I was impressed with the 49ers' defense throughout the game, but what Pete Carroll was saying about offensive penalties and that he was saying that the Seahawks had 9 drives, and 3 of them were basically derailed by crippling offensive penalties.
Yeah, it wasn't even necessarily, you know, the penalties themselves. It was just kind of when they happened.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have a 1st and 10 that goes to a 1st and 25 because of hands to the face. And you're suddenly in a position where you're almost never going to pick up that first
down. Weird thing about that play, on that series, I believe, was when Russell blew a timeout.
Yes.
And that, I don't want to say that That lowered the Seahawks' chances of winning so significantly.
Yes.
By blowing that timeout there. I mean, they would have ended up with over a minute left at the end of the game if they would have had that extra timeout.
It completely changed the complexion of the game.
It was one of the more shocking mistakes of Russell Wilson's career.
I think that's a situation where, as a quarterback, you're just drilled to think clock running down, use timeout. And I think that's one that we have to change. Like, it's not individual quarterback. It's not on Russell Wilson, but it's like all of us have to realize that those 5 yards are not necessarily worth a timeout, especially in the second half.
I don't know what we're going to do about it. but we can officially say that those 5 yards are not worth it.
I can tell Bill Barnwell to try and write about it.
But honestly, I thought that the 49ers defense played really good. They were all over the receivers. There was no separation, which was a massive difference from that Saints game where receivers were running open on every play. They did such a good job of limiting Russell running.
Yeah, to me that was part one of what happened, is they took that option away.
There was conversation about it the next day. Basically, the conversation was, why didn't Russell run more? And I think it was not that. It was as if there was some sort of logic to it. It wasn't that there was any logic to it. It was that they were all over it.
Yeah, it was the 49ers' choice and not the Seahawks' choice.
Yes. And Pete Carroll said that they were following him every single play. There was no separation on plays where Russell either could have passed or run. The linebackers were following him very closely. But I saw this from quick reads for Russell. So it said that throwing to his left or up the middle, Wilson went just 4 of 9 for 16 yards and 2 first downs. To his right, though, he went 11 of 16 for 183 yards and a touchdown. And I think to his left would be Alden Smith.
To me, I think that's more about the fact that he's putting more pressure to run when he rolls right, traditionally.
More pressure to run when he rolls right, yeah.
So I think he's forcing that linebacker to step up and opening holes that way. And guys who roll right-handed quarterbacks are usually better throwing to their right.
That could be, but it's such a significant difference there that, and Russell is somebody who usually spreads the ball around really evenly. You usually don't see these big differences for him.
No.
I was trying to give credit to Alden Smith and you're taking it away. I mean, I think that it was a huge factor though, and it was somebody who, for the previous Seahawks game, didn't really seem like much of a factor at all. Those linebackers were something to deal with in this game.
I think we saw, in general, the most complete San Francisco team probably all year, you know, when you look at getting Crabtree back on the offensive side of the football and having him at least as a presence.
It's true. It opened things up for them offensively, and they really were targeting Byron Maxwell in a lot of ways. There were only a couple times that they threw it Sherman's way. If Kaepernick had a drop back and didn't scramble, because he scrambled a lot, if he didn't scramble, he was throwing the ball to whomever Byron Maxwell was covering.
Yeah, that side of the field in general, I think Malcolm Smith was also on that same side of the field coming in after KJ Wright went down with his broken foot. So targeting the less experienced side. Maxwell came up with the big interception in the red zone that could have loomed large had the Seahawks won, but also got beaten a few times.
It's true, and it's something that also in that Saints game, you know, Drew Brees was looking to target Byron Maxwell but couldn't do it. Byron Maxwell and Jeremy Lane were all over everything. And then this game, Maxwell did give a little.
Yeah, I'm not sure that it was any worse than would have happened if Brandon Browner was in there, because a lot of it was by penalty, and Browner is, you know, also very susceptible to that.
It's true, they were calling it very close.
Yeah, and I think Seahawks 49ers is probably, other than maybe Broncos, you know, some team, Patriots don't really do it anymore, but some team that would be very physical with the Broncos receivers, Seahawks 49ers is probably the game that's most dependent on how it's refereed, because of the way that Jim Harbaugh likes to work the referees through the media, through the sidelines, through any other means.
League office. So let's talk about the last series.
Let's.
We were talking, so first question, let's break it down.
Wait, I actually want to go down one before.
Okay.
The Seahawks final series.
I want to talk about that also.
Okay.
So first down, there's the big Golden Tate return, and I believe they got a first down after that.
Yeah.
And then it was first down run to Lynch, short gain. Second down, and this is the play that you want to talk about, which was another run to Lynch for another short gain.
Yeah, and that seemed to me to be getting awfully conservative in the red zone. It was basically a situation of, like, we don't want to screw up this go-ahead field goal. But I think in that scenario, there was so much time on the clock, you still had to be playing for a touchdown. So they did throw on third down on that drive.
But it was third and long.
Yeah, it was third and eight, and an incomplete pass to Jermaine Kearse, and then on comes Hauschka for the field goal.
And so I think in that situation, it wasn't just that it was conservative, it was that it didn't fit in with the rest of the day's game plan.
I mean, they certainly hadn't been doing big things with Marshawn Lynch on the ground.
And most often, if they ran first down and it was unsuccessful, they were passing second down.
Yeah.
This was one of the first times I can remember all day where they did run, pass on third and long.
Yeah, that is a pretty rare combination. It's kind of like the Seahawks offense from early last season when they were being very conservative with Russell.
I'm not saying that it was necessarily the wrong decision there, because I think they were expecting at the very least to get the ball back. They were expecting it was either defensive stop and you get the ball back with a chance to take a pretty significant lead, or San Francisco moves down the field and scores quicker than they did.
I don't know. I think when you're in that situation, San Francisco took over with 6:20 left in the game. It's not uncommon for that to be the last play series or the last drive of the game. In fact, I mean, they actually went faster, I think, than you would have expected with that big Frank Gore run.
So with that Gore run, do you think that he was injured or do you think he was intentionally coming down?
I think he was injured. I don't think that it was anything intentional.
I've heard both things. I've heard some people theorize that he went down basically game theorying and going down and saving clock. If he scores that touchdown, the game's completely different.
The game is completely different, but we're in a situation where, you know, had the Seahawks stopped them on that drive, you're talking about getting the ball back with something like 2:30 left. And down by 2 points.
Yeah.
So that versus touchdown.
The chances of victory are very high there. So they have the third down play, 3rd and 7. They roll out with Kaepernick, right? And you were noticing this live while we were watching it, that the Seahawks didn't have the numbers.
Yeah, it was just a scenario. Like, as soon as he ran, you could see that they were in deep trouble because I think it was Jeremy Lane and, you know, maybe one other cornerback on that side, and that was pretty much it. The linebackers were all shaded towards the other side of the field, and San Francisco is pulling their linemen and has a bunch of big guys out in front of Kaepernick, and it was just the absolute perfect play call in that situation.
I have to give credit to the 49ers there also. That was a play that they hadn't run all game. They'd run various Kaepernick runs, but not that specific play, and it just looked different too. He didn't have any option to pass. It was definitely the first time that they'd run that play. Right?
Yeah, it's a traditional, like, our quarterback keeping the ball and running into the line like a running back. And that's, you know, they famously ran that with Alex Smith in the playoffs against New Orleans a couple years ago to win that game. And again, it came up big for them.
So then after that, you move to the conversation of, should they let the 49ers score?
Well, I think before that, you have the question of, they started using timeouts right away.
And I think that was the right decision.
I also think so.
Pete Carroll used the timeouts perfectly in that situation. Because like you were saying, if we get the ball back there, they kick a field goal, you stop Colin Kaepernick on third down, you get the ball back down 2 with over 2 minutes left, or around 2 minutes left, you expect to move the ball downfield and get a chance at a game-winning field goal.
At first glance, it seemed too early to me, but given how close it worked down to the two-minute warning, A, and then B, the fact that you always want to use your timeouts on defense instead of offense because you can stop the clock more quickly on offense.
And you almost always want to use your timeouts before the two-minute warning.
I don't know if I necessarily agree with that, but it's definitely defense versus offense, and, you know, they reasonably expected to be off the field after that 3rd and 7 situation.
Yeah, I thought that Pete handled the game really well. I thought that Pete called... I don't want to say it was one of his best games of all time, but Pete called the game perfectly. He didn't do anything noticeably wrong during the game. The only thing that you can really question, I suppose, is the allowing the 49ers to score at the end of the game.
Well, to me, it was a no-brainer that you had to allow the 49ers to score there. There was just too little time left on the clock by the time you got the ball back. You know, eventually 21 seconds when they ran their first play. So...
I agree with you, but that begs the other question of, do you think that the 49ers would have scored?
Well, apparently Jim Harbaugh was on the radio this morning and told KNBR in San Francisco that he would, in fact, have scored in that situation, which is kind of interesting because, if someone else is telling you, hey, we want you to score this touchdown, you probably should not score the touchdown.
I agree.
You think they're stupid.
I agree.
But I think, you know, coaches are very risk averse. And in that situation, you know, you start thinking we can take the sure points instead of messing around with this. But, you know, Pete Carroll talked about the possibility of blocking the kick or ripping the ball out in a fumble. And those percentages are so low compared to having 2+ minutes to potentially drive.
It's true.
It makes sense to me that it also would have been very difficult to execute on first down before the 2-minute warning, because you just don't have a chance to really discuss it and then talk to the players. Everything's happening very quickly. But in the future going forward, I hope that they would reconsider that thought.
Well, so I thought it was also pretty cool that Pete Carroll said, we're going to do some research on it.
Yeah.
He was saying that. I was like, he's just like Bill Barnwell. He's going to put it into Pro Football Reference, see what comes up, see if anybody's ever won in that situation.
I don't feel like Pete individually is going to do that.
No.
I think they've got some people to do that, but yes. I like that.
He's an old man. He's not going to be able to figure that out.
He uses computers, okay?
No, Pete Carroll can figure anything out. He's figured out modern rap music, right? Pete Carroll's friends with Snoop Dogg. He can do anything he wants.
I hear Pete Carroll's like working on the string theory that they're developing. Yeah. Some of the modeling that's going on. Anything. But
I thought that was really cool. And I think that I have this weird speech pattern thing that I've picked up, which is talking like Pete Carroll. He says really cool a lot, right?
He does.
He is like, he was saying this about the Saints game a couple of weeks ago, and he was like, I just really liked seeing how happy everybody was on the sideline. I thought that was really cool, the vibe on the sideline. And I picked this up from Pete Carroll because I'm trying to model my life after Pete Carroll.
We really need the Pete Carroll scale. You're moving rapidly towards being more
right,
Pete Carroll.
Right, I've tried to inform in my work a lot more energy and a lot more saying that things are really cool.
I'm glad that that's what you've taken from Pete Carroll's philosophy.
We'll do the research on that. Something that I say. It's really cool. But I do. So I think that not allowing them to score fits in with the general Pete Carroll philosophy.
Yeah, that's one thing he mentioned is, you know, we're always competing. So scoring a touchdown, allowing a touchdown potentially is not really part of that. But in this case, the numbers, I think someone went through and did the math.
I just don't think you can fault Pete Carroll for being Pete Carroll.
No. It's part of the whole Pete Carroll thing. But maybe Pete Carroll can learn as well.
It's true. And he was saying that he's open to learning.
Yeah.
So, should we look forward, or is there more about the 49ers to discuss? I suppose, let's talk about how scary are the 49ers now.
Again, I don't know if they're more scary than they were beforehand. I think that if you're assuming that the team that the Seahawks beat in week 2 is the same 49ers you would potentially face in the playoffs, that's a mistaken assumption because they're a much better team now because they're healthier. But
just Crabtree? You think Crabtree is that important?
I know, did Manningham play in that game? I don't think he did he?
Yeah, you're right about that, yeah.
So they were really depleted in the wide receiver core at that point. And, you know, Kaepernick had basically 2 receivers he felt comfortable throwing the ball to. So obviously the Seahawks could take that away. But the fact is, if you look at the last 2 games in Seattle, the Seahawks have won by, I believe it's 55 points. And the last 2 games in San Francisco, they've lost by 9.
Mm-hmm.
The Seahawks are a better team.
Yeah.
You'd be playing at home. I don't know that they're the scariest team out there.
I really don't know who's the scariest team. We know who's not the scariest team, and that's whoever wins the NFC North. But of the reasonable options for them to play in a potential home playoff games, you're getting everything at home between Carolina, New Orleans, and San Francisco. I think that New Orleans
Philadelphia.
Philadelphia is hard to read. I have a hard time getting a sense of what Philadelphia would look like against the Seahawks, partially because we haven't played them, and we've played all those other teams.
Yeah.
But I think that New Orleans is the least scary. Carolina and San Francisco, I think, are pretty much even.
Yeah, I mean, Carolina maybe downgraded a little bit after they struggled as much as they did at New Orleans on Sunday night. That was a little bit of a disappointment on their part.
They both kind of have a hard time. You don't feel 100% confident in the Carolina or San Francisco offenses moving the ball consistently.
But the big thing is they can shorten the game.
Yes.
And make it a lower scoring game. And, you know, we talked about this last week, I think, but one play looms larger in that scenario as opposed to a game like New Orleans, you're going to be moving the ball up and down the field, You're going to have lots of chances to prove your superiority, basically, in that situation.
And this last week, both teams are really trying to shorten the game. There was a lot of just running play clock.
Yeah, it ended up very similar to the Carolina game in that regard.
So do we want to look forward to the Giants now?
Does anyone look forward to the Giants?
No. I mean, yes.
Wide receivers look forward to playing the Giants. Defensive backs?
Defensive backs, especially. So looking at the Giants, I was a little bit surprised. They're actually a better defensive team than I thought they would be. They've given up a lot of points this last year, and Football Outsiders has them ranked 10th defensively.
Wow, I would not have seen that coming.
So 28th offensively and 31st in special teams. They're giving up a lot of cheap yardage there, right? So they're giving up a lot of really good field position, and Eli Manning is giving up a lot of pick sixes.
So they're allowing more points than they are there, are yes. actually attributable to the defense.
So the defense is kind of what I think that we thought the Giants' defense would look like. It's just that Eli Manning at this point is playing like one of the worst starting quarterbacks in the NFL.
We were having this conversation earlier where you were like, you know, if you have a star quarterback, why would you keep playing them at this point in the season after you're out of the playoff race? And I pointed out that maybe the Giants don't have a star quarterback anymore.
I still believe in Eli Manning long term. I think that Eli Manning will be probably a fine quarterback next year and beyond. But this is definitely Eli Manning's crappy year.
Wait, how old is Eli Manning that you're confident in him going forward?
Quarterbacks fluctuate.
That's true, but he's 32. He's going to be 33 by the start of next season. I feel like Eli Manning's best football is in the rearview mirror.
Per Football Outsiders, consistent starting quarterbacks who are worse than Eli Manning, you've got EJ Manuel, who's a rookie. You have, let's say Brandon Whedon is generally a consistent starting quarterback, unfortunately, at this point. Terrell Pryor and Geno Smith. So two rookies, and basically Terrell Pryor is a rookie at this point also. And then there's Eli Manning, who has two Super Bowls.
One of these things is not like the others. One of these things just doesn't belong.
He and Geno Smith are tied with 20 interceptions. How many interceptions do you think the Seahawks get this week?
I feel like two.
Four.
Four!
Four interceptions.
Wow. Wow. I feel like this is a big week. Richard Sherman, if he's going to get the Defensive Player of the Year season back on track, needs at least one interception.
Yeah, it's been a little bit derailed, I feel. His Defensive Player of the Year season, he hasn't had an interception in quite a long time.
I don't think it's over, but it's tough because he's not going to really have an opportunity to capture the spotlight again the rest of the season.
He might need to pick off Eli Manning four times himself.
Well, that would be a good
And return them for touchdowns. No, it's unfortunate for Richard Sherman. And this is what happens with cornerbacks in a lot of ways. People just don't throw at him, so he doesn't get the chance of making these big highlight plays.
And he might on Sunday.
Yeah, you would hope so.
I mean, I think the recipe for the Seahawks is pretty simple. It's get an early lead, force the Giants to play from behind, turn Avril and Clemens loose in terms of the pass rush that's been effective at the last couple of weeks, and then try to make some plays on Eli Manning and put the game away and make it a laugher.
Absolutely. The Giants running game has gotten a little bit better with the return of Andre Brown. It's still not what I would consider one of the best running games in the league. And Eli Manning is going to be in a lot of third and longs, and he's going to make a lot of bad decisions.
That's the hope.
So, I mean, the Giants kind of are, they are what we thought they were. They're not any good, you know? They're a team who, if I had to pick the spread myself, I heard what it was today. It was about 10 or so. I feel like it should be in the 14.
I think it was much lower than that.
14 to 16 range.
You know, I think the one thing is they, looking at their splits DVOA defensively, they're sixth against the run. So it may be a situation where you come out passing, kind of like that New Orleans game, pass to set up the run rather than running to set up the pass.
Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I think that the Seahawks will probably still come out running the ball, despite that, because they're still always wanting to establish the run. Chances of victory in this game?
I would say somewhere around... The line, by the way, is Seahawks by 7.
Yeah, it should be at least double that. To be honest, I think that that is a very...
Double that.
I think it's a really conservative line, and I think that people consistently give the Giants more credit than they deserve this season.
Well, I think that often happens with big market teams.
The Giants started out 0-6, and there was a lot of talk about them making the playoffs.
Yeah, but a lot of that was you're listening to a Cowboys fan who is like scheming the worst possible way that his team could lose the division.
This was coming in a lot of different ways, though.
I mean, it's their history of the fact that you know, they've been a Super Bowl contender and a champion as recently as, what, that was 2 years ago?
Yeah.
So I think that's a lot of it. But it's historically, they always were good in the first half and struggled in the second half of the season before picking it up in the playoffs. So when they had a really bad first half, that was probably not a sign that they were not going to do it.
I mean, they're just not a good team. They're one of the worst five teams in the NFL. This game...
There's a lot of bad teams out there.
I would rather be playing the Giants than the Jacksonville Jaguars.
Yeah.
I would rather be playing the Giants than the Cleveland Browns.
No, I'm not willing to go that far.
There are a few teams I would rather play. The teams that I would rather play than the Giants are Oakland, the Washington Redskins.
Washington professional football team.
Houston... Maybe the Jets, and I think that's it.
Yeah, I suppose that's true. I mean, they're not far outside of the bottom five in DVOA. I think you're giving maybe a little bit too much credit to Jacksonville for beating Houston recently.
Jacksonville's on fire!
Their weighted DVOA is still last in the league.
Jacksonville is on fire.
Okay, well, if you say so. You said it really loud, so it must be true. Yeah.
I'm in a 100% chance of victory.
This 100% chance of victory! Wow.
This game reminds me of the game in Toronto against Buffalo last year. We're going into it probably a little bit more nervous than we need to be.
You're obviously not.
Well, yeah, it's true, I suppose. I went into the Buffalo game really nervous about it, and then they won easily. The game was over in the first quarter.
I would say 85% chance.
85%?
You're still on the road.
Yes, but you're playing Eli Manning.
Well, you were playing Kellen Clemens a few weeks ago.
Kellen Clemens is really good. You got Eli Manning and E.J. Manuel. Or no, Geno Smith. Those are the two worst quarterbacks in the NFL. Brandon Whedon's in there somewhere. Those are the quarterbacks that I want to play against the most. Eli Manning is... He's taken the year off. Eli Manning has forfeited the season. They're out of playoff contention. They've got nothing to play for. They aren't even really playing spoiler at this point, because beating the Seahawks wouldn't affect the Seahawks too dramatically. It's not like a feel-good win.
Kellen Clemens has been worse on a per-play basis this season than Eli Manning.
I don't believe these stats that you're looking at.
The coveted 34 QBR from Kellen Clemens. Really good.
I really like Kellen Clemens. So 85%?
Yeah.
And so let's close talking about fantasy football. The fantasy playoffs are upon us.
Are upon one of us.
are upon me. Yeah. After week one, I believe I'm up 128 to 78, something like that. I've all but won my first round fantasy matchup. We do 2 weeks and then close out. 16 and 17 is 2 weeks.
Are you going to guarantee 100% chance of victory there as well?
100% chance of victory.
Wow.
Would you not guarantee? Do you see how much I'm up by?
You are up by 45 points. So.
That would be a pretty epic failure. That would be a failure of gargantuan proportions for me to not make the finals. But on the other side, the matchup that I'm looking at against, so I have 132 to 87 from Mrs. Fantasy Genius who I'm playing. And on the other side, we've got the Greenwood Timbers, David, at 122, and the SeaTac Shit Geese, Nick, at 130. A close competitive matchup. I'm scared of those teams.
That's going to come down to possibly even the Monday night game next week.
But looking at players to claim for these last couple weeks, I mean, this might be the same in most leagues. There's nobody out there. Everybody is owned. I mean, I was looking at potential. I was like, well, I might throw in something on Toby Gearhart, you know?
Yeah.
Derek Rogers, there's really nothing that's out there right now that's particularly interesting. Marcel Reese. Oh, Cordarrelle Patterson was one player. But Cordarrelle Patterson's somebody who's so up and down. Am I going to be playing Cordarrelle Patterson in a fantasy football final?
Sadly, there's a guy out there who scored a 38 last week, but a projection of zero.
Josh McCown.
Josh McCown of the Fighting McCowns.
I probably would not feel confident playing him. So once you've reached this point, I mean, there's only really four players who are really paying attention, unless it's you who probably is still paying attention.
Absolutely.
You play till the last minute. You play till the last minute.
If they keep score, I want to win.
But as far as changing teams around, I don't think that there's going to be a lot of it at this point. I actually have no claims in. I considered putting in a claim for Cordarrelle Patterson. We're past the bye weeks, so my roster is flushed out. I spent a lot of time building up a lot of players to reach this point, and now I'm spending a lot of time not playing those players.
I mean, I feel sort of similar. My only claim in this week is on a defense for week 16.
It's true.
So
defenses are something to look forward to. I've got the Chiefs defense this week playing against Oakland, I believe. They've got a really cushy matchup this week. And then looking at the players who I've kind of hoarded for a long time, I mean, I stuck away Anquan Boldin, Michael Crabtree, Michael Floyd, Percy Harvin. I'm not going to probably play any of those players.
You dump Shane Vereen?
Shane Vereen's in the starting lineup.
Okay, yeah, because he had the big week last year.
I think Shane Vereen's great. So he's somebody who I have hoarded and eventually moved to the starting lineup. But who in here would I rather have Cordarrelle Patterson than? You know?
Your team is great. We already know this.
That's not... I think it's not necessarily that my team is great. It's that once you reach this endpoint, you've been fleshing out your roster so much that you've reached a point where you have so many players who you'd rather have than anybody who's out there on waivers. And the significant injuries that happened this last week, you've got Adrian Peterson and Rob Gronkowski, right? Adrian Peterson looks like there's a chance he'll come back. Toby Gerhardt is also questionable. And then Rob Gronkowski, what do you have behind him?
But you may need to claim someone else if you have Gronkowski. So there is that aspect.
Hopefully you've got somebody on your bench because there's nobody out there.
One guy I wanted to throw out there, Derek Rogers from the Colts.
Yeah.
6 catches for 107 yards last week in his debut.
Man, he's coming up 0 for the rest of the season. So the amount
apparently
that
he did not know the playbook previous to last week.
Apparently he didn't know he was on the team.
They got him mid-season, as I understand it.
And he just learned the playbook and then put up a 22. That's impressive. But I would not put too much stock in Derek Rogers putting up another 22.
Yeah, that would be unlikely. But someone's got to catch passes for the Colts.
So here's a weird question, and this is something that I think about. I feel like I've lost the fantasy football drive.
I mean, it's...
This is not something that you've ever had to experience because you haven't won as many championships as I have. But
I don't know that any of our listeners want to hear this.
I'm sitting here having won 4 out of the last 6 championships with a good chance of making it 5 out of 7.
This is basically a verbal first world problems.
And I feel like...
No, it's more of a humble brag, really.
I can't get as excited about fantasy football as I could 2 years ago or 3 years ago.
Well, I'm reading Wooden right now by Seth Davis. I've got an advanced copy of that book that comes out next month.
There's your humble brag.
That is. And you may want to study that to see how he kept motivated after winning.
What did he do? Can you give me some advice?
I haven't gotten to that section
before. Oh, yeah. Whenever you get there, let me know.
I'm still only on his looking for his second championship.
I mean, Michael Jordan had to retire after winning 3, take a couple years off. I'm wondering, do I have to do this with fantasy football? Give somebody else a chance?
I'm pretty sure the answer is no.
I think that I might.
You also haven't won this year.
I know.
You're aware of that, right?
I know, and it's really competitive. It'll be a very competitive
final.
This
is an amazing jinx right now.
It'll be one of the most competitive finals that I ever play in. But I'm being honest about this. The amount that I feel feelings about fantasy football is not the same as it used to be.
Well, that's unfortunate. I think Pete Carroll would tell you always compete. So maybe you're not being Pete Carroll enough in your life.
I am competing. I'm not competing. I'm really looking forward to the challenge of getting myself excited about this week of fantasy football, even though I'm up by 50 points.
Wow.
How Pete Carroll did that sound? I'm up for the challenge.
I'm going to start studying Pete Carroll interviews and like adopting his mannerisms and everything.
I'll do that. I think he wears too many hoodies and khakis. Those are 2 things that I cannot do.
I can go far, but I can't go that far.
I can't go khaki far.
Well, we wrap things up as usual with our update on Jermaine Kearse, who scored a 1 last week, 2 catches for 15 yards. And Kearse now with 45 points for the season, continues to lead Vic Ballard 45-6. And ESPN has this to say about him. He has minimal fantasy value. All right, well, thanks for listening.
Thank you.